It's time for Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Mat-Su Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky.
Well, folks, it's time for another edition of Valley Edition. It's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio, she made it all the way in, Terry Snyder. Welcome, Terry.
Nice to be here, Mike.
And on the phone, calling from somewhere in the Northland, Saz Hollander. Welcome, Saz.
Hey, Mike. Greetings from the Susitna Valley.
Susitna Valley. Wonderful. We cover things very well. Well, we have a number of events that have happened this past week that are deserving of some attention. But I know, Saz, let's start with a topic that you have been covering and that involves a robbery. Is it that what we're looking at? A rather
It was a stolen vehicle undercover sweep that police in Anchorage conducted last week and announced this week. And they arrested, you know, 24 people, about half of them on, you know, vehicle theft charges and the rest on weapons charges, drug charges, warrants. And it was part of a kind of a concerted effort by APD, which is not Mat-Su, but has connections certainly, to start kind of getting a handle on the really high number of stolen vehicle reports made in Anchorage, some of which involve people from the Valley or, you know, suspects from the Valley and perhaps victims from the Valley. And cars that may or may not end up here. But, in January, Chief Dahl started bringing in detectives every time there was a stolen vehicle report, just to try to get eyes on, you know, not only the vehicles themselves, but the other accessory crimes that tend to come with these vehicles. You know, police say that it is often they're seeing a few trends with the stolen vehicles. They aren't seeing location trends, at least in Anchorage. It's sort of throughout the municipality. But they see kind of surges in types of vehicles stolen. For a while, it was like early 2000 Chevys. Now it's old Subarus. And it's because people who are stealing these vehicles get good at working with the ignition systems and then pass along those tips. And so it's certain types of ignition systems and certain types of vehicles they get good at breaking into. And a lot of these thefts are linked to other crimes and drugs. That, you know, you're seeing reports of, like, you know, 10-year-old older, you know, late 90s vehicles being stolen. And they aren't necessarily being sold. They're being driven from one spot to another.
Wow.
Sometimes they're being, so they're transportation. Or they're being, and crimes of opportunity because people leave their cars running, especially in winter with the keys in them. Or they're using them as part of a larger kind of a drug deal, driving the cars to a drug dealer as part of, you know, maybe an exchange, and then the dealer can use the car to conduct business. So there are different reasons for it. You know, one of the statistics that the police released was a table of stolen vehicle reports from 2014 till now. And the total reported stolen vehicles was over 10,000.
Holy cow.
Which is stunning. But also stunning is that most of them were recovered. And so as traumatic as it is to get your car stolen, I didn't do the percentages, but it was more than 9,000 of them have been recovered.
Do you know if that is outside the Anchorage area? Is it as big a problem as it is here?
I don't think the numbers would be as high just because we're so much more spread out.
Sure.
But absolutely, it's a problem here.
Well, let me ask a question of you, who both of you have a vehicle or two or whatever, and I do as well. Thinking back over the last, say, 10 years or given some period of time, do you find that you have changed the way you are locking your vehicle or making sure that things are not in it when either you're parking in your own driveway or, for that matter, at a trailhead? Let's start with Terry. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I live right on the street, and so pretty highly visible. It's rare that our cars do go in and out of the garage. But, yeah, I think that's what a lot of it is you know, somebody leaving a door open and something on the seat that's easy. It's crimes of opportunity, a lot of it. But And I think the new technology on cars, I have a newer model car that's made it a little easier because it's automatically locks when I walk away. And I listen for that beep. But I say absolutely I've changed my style when it comes to, and even riding alone in my vehicle. I mean, it automatically locks. It gives me that opportunity in my vehicle to make that adjustment. And I think a lot of these crimes are just simply opportunity crimes. Auto start is kind of a beautiful thing if you have to start your car because your key isn't in it. And it's mine, at least, would stop the minute anybody walked in it, didn't have a key. So,
what about you, Zoss?
Oh, yeah. I hate to say it, but you're crazy if you don't lock your car. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a kind of rural area. We didn't in New Jersey, and we never locked any of our vehicles and, lived in kind of rural places in the West. But then moved to Anchorage and I live, in a sort of a rural part of, well, two different rural parts of Mat-Su. But yeah, I lock my car. I have my car kind of rifled through twice, in other places, and it's, just small stuff stolen. I had a dog in the car. He wasn't stolen. It was with mail. But
that's another problem.
All my tapes were stolen. The dog let somebody take all my music at the time.
Was your car locked or unlocked?
It was locked.
Wow.
I don't remember if they jimmied it or if the window was broken. I don't remember how that worked now. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's certainly up here now at trailheads and, in driveways. You can lock your car and still have your car stolen is the other thing. I mean, you should always lock your car, but I see lots of reports of people who are like, it was locked. They stole my car anyway. It was locked. The keys weren't in it. So.
What about you, Mike?
Well, I would say that I'm thinking over since we have lived here in downtown Palmer, we have two vehicles that we have in our driveway, and we have just a habit of locking them. And I think I don't sense in myself this fear that it's going to be stolen so much, but there's a range of possibilities that include a young kid coming by, I mean real young, and somehow getting into the car or whatever. So we just lock it. And I also make a habit, which is the more difficult thing actually, to ensure that if we have anything in the car, mm-hmm. we take it out of the car.
Yeah.
That we don't leave something there. I don't leave a coat in there. I don't leave, et cetera. We do have some emergency stuff that's in a container, but it's mm-hmm. down and out of the way. And I think the same thing is true on the streets of, I have to say, the streets of Palmer. It's just something that we have forced ourselves to be habitual about. You pull up, even if you're just running in to the post office or whatever, just lock the car. And I have not had the experience at any time here in Alaska of having anything being stolen because I think, in part, I believe that we've done what we've done. But we have stories from friends or, as you pointed out, some people who have noted that even if you put your car in your garage, and this is where it gets to be really interesting because Emily Forstner did a piece about crime in the Valley for us. And she started out by describing an incident at her home over in the Wasilla area, going into the garage and finding that her car, which had been parked in the garage and presumably was relatively safe, had been gone through.
Hmm.
So I guess my question by asking you is about this, your own personal experience, is whether the times there are changing and for whatever reason it's more likely to have a vehicle broken into or stolen these days than 10 years ago.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know also what the number of vehicles are on the road. I mean, when I lived in Anchorage, which has been about 20 years ago now, but on the Bluff in Anchorage, in a very nice neighborhood, we had cars stolen in our neighborhood even back then. I know people weren't as reticent of locking their cars at that time, and mostly it was occasions of joyriding, I think, more than what this is symptomatic of. But, I don't think it's a new phenomenon, but it'd be interesting to know, people are, even out here, you don't have to pay the licensing fees anymore if your car is a certain age, so it's a little cheaper to have a car. And if there's an out here, because of the poor public transportation, you're kind of forced to have a car. So it'd be interesting to see how what the number of cars are as you know 10 years ago and the crime rate and how that all overlays.
Okay, well, I'd like to move on to two topics which I'm wondering if they're somehow related to one another. We've recently watched on a national stage, and in fact have had Alaskans who have traveled to Washington, D.C., to participate in one way or another in the ongoing discussion that involved the Senate looking at the appointment of a new Supreme Court justice. And of course, as many listeners know, that went to the point where he was appointed, and our own senior senator, Lisa Murkowski, emerged with a somewhat controversial, depending on how you stood on the Kavanaugh appointment, position, where she stood out from her party, the Republican Party, which voted in favor, by voting technically present, but actually no. So I'm curious, as you two look on at this and her career here in Alaska and in the Senate, what does this imply for the future, for her career? Let's start with Terry.
Nothing. I think at this point, you know, as much as people roar, I mean, people should keep in consideration, Lisa Murkowski is not up for election for four more years. Mr. Sullivan, who will come up first in 2 years, and he, for the people that were against this appointment, he's been a yes all along. He certainly didn't have the amount of pressure that was on Senator Murkowski. And whether she will even run it for another turn is an unknown at this point, or if she'll run for another office. And I think as much as the Republican Party are huffing and puffing, she knows in her back pocket that's not who really got her elected, because she was the first write-in candidate ever to go to the Senate from here. And I think she listened pretty carefully to what the tribes wanted and what women wanted and the plurality of people wanted, not to move it out of committee, you know, or on to the floor for a vote. You know, then voting present didn't really change the equation. She's got somewhat of a record of doing that, kind of making both sides happy, so to speak. But what is it going to do to her career? I don't think anything, honestly. But I've been wrong before.
What Zaz, opinion.
That's pretty much exactly what I was going to say. I don't think that her actions with the Kavanaugh nomination are drastically different from some actions, at any rate, on prior legislation. And that, you know, she has kind of cast herself as a Trump skeptic, let's mm-hmm. say, on the GOP side.
Okay.
And I think that plays to her, whatever her base is here.
So there was one comment that I found interesting made by the leader in the Senate, McConnell, who said she's strong, no problem when she does come up. Any comment about that? You probably both saw that comment.
Yeah, you know, I think what might be interesting is when committee assignments come up again. It was pretty interesting, first of all, that there are absolutely no women on that committee that moved this to the floor for a vote, and that she's one of the few women in the Senate that is an attorney. And there are some speculation about some of the men wanting off that committee. They don't like that hot seat so much, and it'll just be interesting to see where that goes.
Okay. Well, with that, I'd like to see how this plays into something that I've been thinking about, which is the lead-up now, the last few weeks, to the general election in November. I'm wondering whether all of that focus, all that attention paid on the Supreme Court appointment process sort of took people's attention away from the elections coming up and all the balloting. I suddenly, as the appointment was completed, process was completed, I turned around and I said, am I living in a bubble? I mean, I see a few signs. There's some pretty big races going. We have a race for U.S. Congress. We have a three-way race for the governor's position. We have all of the Alaska legislative races. But it seems awful calm. Have I missed something? And Terry, have you been watching and seeing more action?
Well,
given all this money that has been gathered to be spent, mm-hmm. where's it going?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there certainly is. We're not there yet. There's, you know, we're about a month away from it, and they're going to hit heavy on. I've seen a little more television advertising, and I think the radio is probably going to go on fire. And you know, signs. You know, I don't really think that's really so much of a harbinger. I do think that it's going to be. It's very interesting to see some polling that's coming out now showing that Elise Galvin is catching up to Don Young in a pretty big way, and that one's sort of staying off the radar for now. And he's had so many challengers over the years that have come, you know, pretty close and not follow through. But I think that to me is kind of the one to watch, and I think you're going to hear more about that one as it picks up a little more national attention as she starts to close that gap in some of this polling. But, you know, there also is voter fatigue. You know, it's just been going on for so long, and people have become complacent. They think it's a three-way race, and they think it's already it's already been figured out. It's not a presidential race. There's that, I think, that's sort of playing into it.
Okay. Zaz, any comment?
Well, we all know where polling gets us.
Yeah.
Or expectations based on polling gets us.
Yeah.
I think that the governor's race is getting a ton of attention. It seems like there's endorsements almost every day. I know at the paper we're busy tracking all kinds of kind of developments there. But maybe the legislative races, in my bubble, seem to be getting slightly less attention.
Yeah.
I see a lot of signs, but you know, I saw one candidate in particular and thought to myself, does he have an opponent on the, you know, on the other side? And if so, you know, kind of given the demographics here, I hate to say it, but it may not matter that much. Mm-hmm. You know, his name is sort of familiar, and I haven't seen much activity there. But yeah, I think the local races are getting somewhat less attention. But the governor's race is pretty hot.
And what I understand from a number of sources is that the next week's AFN convention is one of those potential turning points, depending upon whether AFN endorses Governor Walker or doesn't endorse anyone, or what appears to be a very long shot, they would lean in the direction of Mr. Dunleavy. But that has been suggested to be a big deal. A lot of the other endorsements seem to be split. They're coming back and forth, one for Walker Public Safety, the other for Begich in terms of Anchorage Police. And trying to evaluate all of that is a little difficult. I wonder whether, if we can turn to the results now that they have been certified, of the local race, which involved the Palmer City Council, whether there's anything to be read in this local result, which had a newcomer, Julie Burbrick, win handily, outperforming the two incumbents and resulting in a fairly significant change in the makeup of the council. She attended her first regular council meeting on Tuesday, and of course Pete LaFrance was reelected and Richard Best was not reelected. Terry, any thoughts about that?
Well, I think that having Julie Burbrick does have a name, well-known name in Anchorage, I'm sorry, in Palmer, and I think that certainly helped, and she's, you know, always cheerful and delightful, and a lot of people know her. And I think maybe part of it is just what I think it's going to come down to, not just polling and all this other stuff, it's just who shows up and what technique that they have to get people to the polls. And you know, people showed up. She got the most votes. She was the newcomer in the race, and she ended up with the most votes of anybody for that one seat. So that just tells me that, you know, they've motivated the right people to come out to the election. And when you compare it to the borough races, which aren't confirmed yet, you know, it's sort of an anti-incumbent race at this point. We don't know yet. They're still doing absentee ballots. So there was just kind of a mixed bag, I think, in this one. Hmm. What did you think, Zaz?
Yeah, I don't have any tea leaves to read on this one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what we're looking at now is maybe something closer to home that you may be able to comment a little bit about. Although you didn't write about this, apparently there was a settlement reached in the Alaska Dispatch News bankruptcy case. Annie Zach reported on that. The former owner and publisher of the Alaska Dispatch News, in some ways the predecessor to the Anchorage Daily News, Alice Rogoff, it was going to pay a settlement, and business goes on. So any comments at all about this, Zaz?
I didn't cover that, so I don't know the ins and outs of it. I guess all I can say is as an employee of Anchorage Daily News, I haven't seen any change in day-to-day operations in the last week or two. Settlement ongoing. You know, the Binkleys run us now.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, you probably do know something about the Burrow cyber attack.
Yes, because there we have, and this is probably a good save for last piece, because I understand you wrote this piece, that the price tag for cyber attack on the Matsu Burrow now tops $2 million.
Yes, indeed. And this was a cyber attack that was discovered in July, probably lay dormant from at least May, I think it was. Of malware that infected, the entire Burrow computer system and servers, and I still aren't entirely back up yet, and they've had to change the way they do email, although Burrow emails hasn't changed, and some of the kind of the more used public aspects of the Burrow computer system, sign your kid up for swim lessons.
Zaz, you're breaking up a little bit. Have you moved your head or moved the phone? Or?
No, I'm sitting in the same spot, but I'll try. Maybe I was waving my arm around.
Okay, you were excited about this. Okay, go ahead. Continue on.
But at any rate, the things are coming back to normal now, you know, a few months later. And yes, at this point, the cost is over $2 million. It sounds like Eric Wyatt, the IT director, didn't expect cost to get that much higher. He said that, you know, over a third of that money is going towards security updates. That were deferred for several years. Mm-hmm. So the system was vulnerable.
So I can anticipate the discussion at the next Burrow Assembly meetings, because as I think back over the years, I know Eric has stepped forward and made certain recommendations, and the Burrow has acceded to some, and on others they've said, well, you know, maybe not. And now to evaluate whether this was the case of, well, you might have saved a lot of money by spending a little more earlier, or have the situations changed, but especially with a slightly changed assembly that's coming there, a couple of people that have to be brought up to speed, I'm going to guess when people look at this kind of price tag, et cetera, there's going to be heavy discussion. What do you think, Terry?
Well, I think in the past it has come up, not just with Mr. Wyatt there. It's been several IT directors that this has come up. And reading your articles, Oz, it sounds like, we're certainly not the only city that has encountered it. There was a huge amount of money that the city of Atlanta, a much bigger city, of course, mm-hmm. did. But so is it that out of line from other cities at same size? It didn't seem so.
You know, I didn't have a lot of time to write up that story. I think I would have liked to have talked with more municipalities around the country. I don't think Atlanta is representative. Obviously, with a anticipated price tag at $17 million, it sounds like their computer system has been the subject of warnings for some time that, hey, you guys are vulnerable. It wasn't just a matter of deferred upgrades, but it was a significant problem that had been brought to light before. From what Eric Wyatt told me, and granted his agenda would be to convince all of us that $2 million is normal, I'm not saying it's not, but from what he's seen, that in the research the Burrow did, that has become the new normal. Initially when this infection was discovered, Eric told the assembly that we're seeing it's about $1 million on average to recover from these things. We're still under that now. This was in August, I guess. And I asked him about that, and he said, well, initially that's what we thought, but after this summer's just flurry of really damaging hacks and cyber attacks, the new estimate is, maybe $3 million is a better estimate.
Wow.
Again, that's coming from the Burrow, but that's what they say they found.
And what percentage of return to normalcy can we put on this Are they 95% or what?
Boy, you know, if you look at the last update the borough did was September 20th, I think, and the, you know, the green, you know, different divisions and different departments and their level of recovery, and a lot of them have green blocks indicating they're recovered, but others have yellow ones indicating they're partly there. A lot of that, I think, is obsolete now or outdated now. So I don't know what the number would be, Mike. 90%?
Wow.
Just guessing.
Is there any word?
But there's some records that won't be recovered is the other thing, and I'm having a hard time figuring out what that is exactly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Eric Wyatt said that there's some records that may have been lost or can't be recovered, but could be recovered, say, if there are emails about legal matters. Maybe they'll be in there. So it's not a straight shot to some historic documents anymore.
Mm. Wow.
And public records requests are being affected.
Wow. Any word from the city of Valdez? Because they had a similar attack, right?
No, I had a really hard time trying to get somebody from Valdez to call me back.
Okay. Well, folks, once again, we're at the end of another edition of Valley Edition. I really appreciate this discussion, and I appreciate Terry Snyder coming into the studio. Thank you, Terry.
Glad to be here.
And Zaz, I appreciate you calling in from that strange location where it sounds like sunspots are settling upon the earth.
Wouldn't that be
nice? I wish. Rain spots. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I'll talk to you both next week. Have a good day.
You've been listening to Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Matsu Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky. Valley Edition is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of hosts or guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, this station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions about this program, email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.